Court will proceed to the fifth case, Cat versus Hatch. Mr. Schooley.
May it please the court, we're here on behalf of Shirley and Gerald Hatch seeking to determine or to obtain review of actually a judgment that was entered in state court proceeding on their behalf.
I don't understand why you didn't put in your fraud evidence in the bankruptcy court.
Well, Your Honor,
you wouldn't have been forfeiting your collateral estoppel argument, but you were able to put in your case in a few hours in the state court, so you could have taken a few hours in the bankruptcy proceeding.
We had only pled. Our original complaint was based upon the collateral effect of the state court judgment.
But why? Why put all your marbles in the collateral estoppel basket when you could have presented your entire fraud case in a couple of hours?
Well, I had the same question because your complaint was about whether this is a dischargeable debt, finally, and there are theories that you have under the Bankruptcy Act for why it is, fraud and so on, and you had the state court judgment, obviously, is one way of trying to show that it indeed should be a non-dischargeable debt if one were to find issue preclusion in the state court judgment, but presumably there are some facts somewhere that you think would also have shown that the criteria of these different sections of the bankruptcy law were. I mean, I thought it was a high-risk strategy myself to sort of...
Well, apparently it was, Your Honor. We're here because of that risk, and frankly, it was our belief that the time and the effort involved with respect to recreation of the evidence of the fraud claim.
I understand the evidence of the fraud claim was just testimony by the Hashes about what Cat had told them.
No, Your Honor, it was not.
How long was the trial?
Approximately an hour.
An hour, okay. So it would have taken an hour in the bankruptcy case to present the same evidence.
Well, Your Honor,
in
effect.
You talked about reconstructing the case. What's that about?
In effect, we did submit the same evidence because we submitted the transcript from the trial.
Well, instead of doing that, why didn't you submit the Hashes? They're still compos mentis, I assume. So.
That's correct, because we believed that the state court.
Well, that's such a terrible mistake. And also, you had to know that your belief was shaky because of the perfunctory character of the of that trial. I just don't get it. I mean, you know, we know for collateral estoppel to apply, there has to be a full and fair hearing, whatever that means. So you must have realized that a court could disagree with your contention that it was a full and fair hearing. Then you'd be completely out of luck if you hadn't presented your fraud evidence to the bankruptcy court.
That was an election that was made by the client, Your Honor.
Why?
Based upon their beliefs that
they don't know anything about collateral estoppel, presumably.
No, Your Honor.
So why didn't they want to repeat their fraud?
Based upon our advice.
Well, then I wouldn't call it really a client election. Let's say you told them to put all their marbles in this basket.
Well, Your Honor, it was a consideration that was reached based upon a discussion with them of the options that were available to them. It was not a straight direction by counsel.
They were reluctant to testify?
No, they were not reluctant to testify.
Then what did they, I don't understand. If it takes an hour to prove this fraud, why didn't they want to spend that hour as a backup to the collateral estoppel argument? Get it.
Frankly, Your Honor, I believe that based upon the determination from the bankruptcy court and the categorization of this claim as simply another disappointed homeowner, that their evidence would have been received with some skepticism in any event. And based upon that, they made the determination that the state court decision being final was what they agreed to stand on. It was not because they didn't sustain damages. That evidence went into the record in the state court. The damages for fraud and the damages and conversion, which were one and the same, the damages for slander of title.
Yeah, it sounds like a default situation. You know, the defendant didn't show up, so the plaintiffs get a default judgment. That's fine. But that's not collateral estoppel country.
Well, Your Honor, we contend that it is.
Default
because
judgment? I thought you were arguing.
No, it was not a default in the traditional sense.
Well, those are important qualifiers. In the traditional sense, it wasn't literally a default, but it's hard to see a difference between a real default and this, aside from the label. And Indiana, it appears, whose law of judgments we would be following under 1738, has a flexible enough judgment law that it doesn't give issue preclusive effect to this kind of cursory, completely uncontested proceeding. Not at all like a summary judgment that's been fully briefed or that somebody, there are many other kinds of ways other than a full trial, of course, where you get a perfectly good judgment, but this one is way over there in the region of default.
Well, Your Honor, the case was set for trial.
And he finds out, well, the judge decides 24 hours before that he's going to accept She decides 24 hours before that she'll accept the withdrawal of this lawyer. It's just a very... And then this complaint, which doesn't even look like it complies with Indiana rules for alleging fraud, since it doesn't have any specific facts showing what exactly was going on. Fraud normally has to be pleaded with specificity. We don't know which representations to hash concerning the construction progress were false. We don't know anything about which withdrawals were made, when they were made. We don't know what's future, what's past. There are all kinds of facts that are not in the pleading. They're therefore not, and they're certainly not developed aside from this little line of leading questions to which Mrs. Hash answers yes every time. This record is just non-existent from the pleadings right on through.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully indicate to the court that Hashes were there ready to present their case without knowing whether or not, without even knowing that the motion had been granted. And what else were they to do? Were they to put on a full day of evidence when the other side does not appear?
Well, if they want issue preclusion effect, perhaps yes, as opposed to essentially the elements of the statute being asked to them. Did they make representations? Yes. Those were false statements? Yes. We don't know which statements were false. We don't know if they were material. We don't know anything. It's just very difficult to say, particularly when now you want to carry it over into the bankruptcy court with very significant consequences there.
The problem with this, Your Honor, is that the defendant, actually the third-party defendant, and his lawyer unilaterally decided not to defend the case. Now, in the face of that, it's difficult for the trial lawyer to perceive that he has to go through on the day of trial when no one appears and do anything but to create a prima facie case, whether or not that's with leading questions or if it's even with affidavits,
but
because there was,
of course, this comes up all the time. You get a judgment against someone, then he declares bankruptcy, the judgment is worthless. But that, you know, that happens all the time. It's just life.
Well, we respectfully don't believe that this judgment is worthless, Your Honor. Counsel was ordered to prepare a proposed entry. It was done. The amount of punitive damages were left blank to be filled in by...
What is the evidence that distinguishes between the role of Cat and the role of his corporation in the fraud?
The evidence would have been that he is the corporation.
Not would have been. What was the evidence?
That is the evidence. He is the only owner. And
that evidence was presented to the state court?
Yes, Your Honor.
He's the sole owner?
He's the sole owner.
And is he treated as an alter ego, or is it a...
I don't believe there was any evidence submitted to the court that would call for alter ego. The problem, I think, with the bankruptcy court's rulings on summary judgment and the judgment is that, in fact, the same claims for slander of title and for abuse of process were also stated against Mr. Cott and the corporation. But the prayer only identified the corporation. The answer that was submitted by counsel for Mr. Cott and the corporation didn't discriminate between that. It recognized that he was sued individually on each of those claims, so when that liability is assessed based upon the evidence that was introduced at trial, there were judgments based upon the liability on those specific claims as opposed to simply relying upon the alter ego theory.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Mr. Gallagher?
May it please the court, it seems to me that the heart of this appeal is Indiana's rather generous standard for applying collateral estoppel in determining the proof.
I find troublesome about your case. It seems to me your client ought to suffer some kind of sanction for his litigating tactics to, you know, I mean, what he did was by initially resisting and, you know, right up to the day of trial, he puts the plaintiffs, now the Hashes, to the trouble of the expense of litigation, and then he thumbs his nose at them, and they end up with a worthless judgment. Shouldn't he be subject to some kind of sanctions for that? There should be some penalty for that behavior.
Just from my experience,
one thing, just not to respond and you suffer a default judgment, then you declare bankruptcy. That's one thing you can do. But to lead the plaintiffs to think that you're going to contest the suit, so they hire a lawyer and they incur expenses, and then they go through the motions of the trial, abbreviated as it was, and then they're just left holding an empty bag. I don't see why your client should be able to get away with that.
Indiana law certainly has at least one remedy where it appears that any litigant is acting oppressively or in bad faith. That's usually then in a cost-shifting order where attorney's fees are imposed on the person who's found to have been vexatious or oppressive.
That would be discharged also, right?
Pardon me?
That would be discharged also, in your view.
That would depend, Your Honor.
dischargeability, theories of dischargeability include either fraudulent conduct, predominantly what's this alleged here, but also willful injury to property. It's a bit of a digression. I'm not very well prepared to talk about that case law. I do think there is case law that says that if somebody acts intentionally, obstreperously in litigation, is sanctioned for that. I think there may be some support for the notion that the sanctions represent a non-dischargeable debt. Of course, not the entire underlying liability, just the sanction, the penalty, which strikes me as fair.
Okay, thanks.
Again, it seems to me that looking at the standards for collateral estoppel that in years past were applied in bankruptcy courts, looking at what is applied more recently, Indiana's standard is really quite difficult for the plaintiff here and generous to Mr. Catt. The bankruptcy court, under the state standard, has discretion. The bankruptcy court's decision not to elect to apply collateral estoppel may be reviewed only for an abuse of discretion.
But how much does that carry over into the federal context? I understand that Indiana may have chosen to build into its collateral estoppel law the kind of flexibility, let's say, that exists for non-mutual offensive estoppel under Parkland hosiery in federal court, with some attention to the quality of the underlying proceeding and incentives to litigate and so on and so forth. But in the final analysis, the bankruptcy judge makes a legal call as to whether this state court judgment will be found dispositive on the issues of fraud and willful conduct, and the appeal then goes to the district court and to here. Why isn't our review de novo of that legal decision about the content of Indiana law and the application of Indiana law? Or would you say it's for clear error? Abuse of discretion, I just can't get anywhere in federal standards of review.
I urge that, Your Honor, because it seems to me truly to make a difference to the outcome of the case. If the abuse of discretion standard means anything, it seems to me, that a bankruptcy judge who's trying to decide the case may look at it and say, I could reasonably go either way and may choose. It suggests that even where a plaintiff has presented a fairly nice, colorable case to apply collateral estoppel, there are also total reasons to go the other way, the bankruptcy court could do that. And if that's what the abuse of discretion review standard means, then to significantly narrow that standard of review, I think is almost to narrow the standard that the bankruptcy judge himself ends up applying.
Right. I mean, there are credibility findings that are made in the bankruptcy court, if I remember correctly. I'm pretty sure it's the bankruptcy court. And I certainly have no problem seeing that this court would normally apply something like clear error review, which is extremely generous when it comes to credibility findings. But I think we need to find some way of marrying our duty under 1738 to apply the state law of preclusion to the state judgment and our duty as a federal court to apply our own procedural rules to things like standards of review, which we typically do.
And perhaps as an advocate here arguing to you, the bottom line for me is that this record, this case, those standards of review perhaps are not very different. Perhaps not much. Perhaps not in this case. Even under a clearly erroneous standard, we're still talking about facts, many, many of them undisputed.
Right, because actually what I'm specifically looking at is in Appendix B of the plaintiff's filing, the bankruptcy court, this is actually page 15 to page 3, the bankruptcy court says, based on the circumstances of this case, the court finds Catt's statements to be credible, and the statements he's referring to that he's just mentioned are that he wasn't aware the trial was proceeding, had he been aware he would have gone, and so forth. And one question is, what weight, if any, do we give to that statement, to that finding that Catt was credible when he said those things?
I think that finding, I think this court must approach as it would in any other finding of fact that comes before this court.
court can give due regard to the trial court's ability to hear the weigh the credibility of the witnesses and not reverse it, but it's very clearly erroneous.
What's the status of Katz Corporation?
The corporation filed its own separate Chapter 7 bankruptcy at the same time, Your Honor, and became defunct. Of course, Chapter 7, corporations in Chapter 7 did not obtain a discharge, so its debt survived along with its charter, which I think is a piece of paper today. I believe that's all there is with a corporation. Much has been said by the lower courts about nuts and bolts issues of fairness here. The court has already touched on those with Mr. Schooley. I think I won't belabor them much, given that my time is short. I'd like to put my finger in my last bit of time on something stressed in several of the Indiana decisions. That is that in weighing the fullness and fairness of the litigation, the court doesn't just look at the objective fairness of the prior litigation, but also considers how one piece of litigation fits with the other, considering the party's incentive and ability to litigate in the prior action versus his incentive to litigate, his stake in the later action. Consider here that in the prior action, Mr. Katt, whose debts were already so great he was going to file a bankruptcy, perhaps had no very great stake in litigating, even had he known whether or not his debts would be $100,000 or $500,000. If you're drowning, you don't care if the water's 10 feet deep or 100 feet deep. On the other hand, in the bankruptcy court, he has an extraordinary stake in litigating the issue. If the debt can't be discharged, it's an economic death sentence, and the plaintiff can levy and execute against him, and he must live completely without assets the rest of his life. Well, those are the points I wanted to stress with you today. Are there any questions that I could answer to you?
Thank you. Mr. Schooley, your time has expired. You may have a minute.
I only wish to respond to what I believe the standard has evolved to in the state of Indiana. And the cases that were cited in the appellee's brief with respect to the second prong, considering overall fairness with the application of estoppel to the set of facts. It's our belief that in reviewing those cases that those arise in circumstances where the collateral estoppel is applied either offensively or defensively to either parties or issues that were not involved in the original action. And so what we have now really it seems to me is the question under circumstances where you have the original litigation followed by second litigation between the same parties on the same issues, that you have the question is, was it fully and fairly litigated? I don't believe that under those circumstances the question of overall fairness of application is appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Schooley. Mr. Gallagher, we will take the case under advisement and the court will